Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Family Matters. I'm Jill Ajeezy and I'm so excited about the show tonight. My co-host, Judge Michelle Laurence, is on her way.
I'm right here.
Picking her up right now. Hello, my dear. How are you?
Well, pretty good. Just wonderful. Thank you. And you?
Well, I'm really good, Michelle, and you and I have had a busy couple of weeks, and I want to start with something that you did last week that if you'd like to give an update on, if you can do that. I'm not sure ethically how that is for you, but I know everyone knows that you were appointed by the Supreme Court to do judges training on parental alienation and visitation interference and shared parenting, and you started that last week. Can you kind of do a little synopsis for us?
Well, I can, and the good news is that the first session, there was about 86 judges. This is judges all over the state of Illinois, and then there was a smaller session, which I think there were about 50, and that's a lot of...
egos in one room.
No, I wasn't going to say that.
Yeah.
You said that. I mean, not that it's not true, but I wasn't going to say that.
Right.
And I will say that people were really, really receptive. You know, the thing that is important to always remember is for judges, because they don't understand it to the degree that is necessary, because it's so finely nuanced and it's so complicated with them thinking that bad parents are using that as an excuse.
Yeah.
Them thinking that regular acting out of children is part of divorce. And figuring out how do you know when it's not, and how do you tell the fine line distinctions, it's really hard for them. So as a result of all of the experts, and as a result of you, Jill, quite honestly, 100%, and not only you, but who you've introduced me to, I was able to really learn and deliver all these nuances that are so confusing for the judges,
mm-hmm.
and they were receptive. And I'm telling you, they really were receptive. I saw it. They kind of want to understand it.
You couldn't ask for more than that. And I hope, you know, as the tentacles of parental alienation are usually very evil tentacles, reaching out to all members of the family and just polluting what was once a good thing, these tentacles are good. And so now we have these judges spreading out through the state of Illinois. Illinois being a guinea pig, you know, in the whole 50 states, and you doing what nobody else is doing all around the country, talking about this and bringing awareness and education to this topic. So we'll see how it spreads and works.
And nobody else is doing it, but I mean, I just don't know.
Well,
you would know.
And I'm saying that, I mean, nobody, no judge is out there talking about this publicly, Michelle. You're it.
The thing is that, you know, it is found at some point in 80% of all the cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, in minor forms, but still damaging to children.
Well, on that note, you and I did something else kind of exciting this week, and we've released our workbook that we've been working for a very, very long time on, and it is a workbook geared to parents and professionals, mental health, legal, anybody that has anything to do with the court system, family court system, should read this workbook and complete this workbook. And if you want to find the workbook, which has been just selling like hotcakes, I have to say, because there's never been a book written like this by a legal professional, let alone a judge and an advocate together, somebody who has been through the alienation process as I have. And so if you want the book, www.parentalalienation911.net, you will see the product and you can see if it's for you. And I hope that it is, and I hope that we help one person, Michelle.
And it's also geared to a whole kind of personal emotional inventory so that you can downgrade your anger and frustration and ally your own case, because it is the heartbreak, it is the anger at the other spouse. It is the frustration with the system which causes people to not act in their own best interest in these cases.
Right.
So we've really worked hard to figure out all these kind of self-investigation skills about how you are in court, what you feel about your spouse, what you've done, and what you've contributed to make sure that you get the result which you want, which is to reconnect with your children. So that's kind of unique.
Absolutely. Well, and there's one more thing I want to talk about is my screenplay of my book, the novel, The Look of Love, which deals with divorce and parental alienation, was done this week. So keep your fingers crossed that that's
a big
feature-length film, and you and I are going to the Academy Awards. That's what I'm hoping for. But tonight, what happens when gay and lesbian couples call it quits? When a couple decides to divorce, there are laws to define the process and protect their rights. But what happens when a couple is gay? Tonight, we have two great lawyers from Chicago, friends of yours, Michelle. So I'm going to let you do the introductions tonight of Richard and Rochelle. Take it. Go for it.
Well, first of all, you know what? These two attorneys, who I so respect, are also longtime friends. Richard and Rochelle, how are you?
We're good.
Great, thank you, Judge.
I like that you're speaking for both of you. Richard, that's very good. So, first of all, Richard Wilson is a founding member and the past chair of the Illinois State Bar Association Standing Committee on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. And he is a partner at Grundin Levitt, concentrating in litigation, appellate practice relating to domestic relations law, actually, with an emphasis on same-sex issues. And very much, Rochelle Grimbaugh is also really prominent in the family law community in all kinds of cases. You've been an attorney since 79, right?
Yes, I have.
And still standing.
Yeah.
But things have changed, and I would imagine your practice has changed a lot.
It's changed dramatically in a lot of ways, actually. But when you say that, 79, I have to stop and say, no, that can't be right, but it's right. It's 79. Practice has changed. A lot of things have changed dramatically, actually.
Not the least of which, in June of 2011.
Yes.
In Illinois, the Religious Freedom Protection and Civil Union Act was passed. And let me ask Richard first. A big deal, but can you explain to our listeners what's the difference between that and actual same-sex marriage?
Sure. In a word, under state law, nothing. And because it's the state that creates the institution of marriage and defines it and regulates it and dissolves it, there's really no functional difference. It's just the word marriage. The law specifically equates parties to a civil union with spouses under Illinois law, under all of Illinois law. So it essentially creates marriage for other than people who marry. You may know, and a lot of people don't, but it doesn't limit it to same-sex couples. Opposite-sex couples can get civil unions, but
right,
in
right.
Illinois. But it's essentially no difference. The problem is the conflict with federal law and the conflict with other states. But as far as Illinois is concerned, if everything were limited within the boundaries of the state, it would be ideal. There would be no reason to have a separate law. We could just call it one thing, whether we call it civil unions or marriage, and everybody would have the same thing. That's what the law essentially intends to do.
So do either of you know how many people are getting united?
Well, I've heard numbers, but I cannot say that I know exactly. I've heard numbers like 1,500, 1,800, but I don't.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, in the State Journal Register, which is the paper in Springfield, Illinois, there were some numbers of the central Illinois counties where it was happening. And it's kind of funny to look at because in Sangamon County, which is the capital where Springfield is located, it was much higher. And I don't recall the exact number, but if you looked at someplace like Adams County where there were two, you know, or over in Pittsfield, Illinois, there's not a lot of gay and lesbian couples getting married. So I would have to think that the bulk of that of those unions were in Cook County.
Well, in Northern Illinois, to be sure. I mean, yeah. DuPage County has seen an extraordinary number of them. But I think you're right. I mean, there have been also down in Metro East, St. Clair and Madison County, and east of St. Louis, there have been quite a number. But I think it does follow population concentrations. But I think there's also been somewhat of a reluctance, which is similar to what's happened in New Jersey, but not quite as much because a lot of couples have decided that, well, they can drive into Iowa without any requirement of residency and get married. And so if they can get a marriage in Iowa, why do they need to bother with an Illinois civil union for it, particularly because these barriers are breaking down and it's becoming much more of a problem for everybody because every state is doing something different. And so the idea that you have to do it within your own state is less appealing to a lot of people now because it's easier, for example, to go to Iowa than to go to Toronto or go to New York.
Well, have you had any civil union divorces yet?
Oh, yeah.
Well, so then they had to be married under a few months.
Oh, no. Wow. The law says – I'm sorry, Rochelle. Were you gonna,
no, go ahead.
No, the law is Section 45 of the – or Section 60, sorry, expressly gives relationship recognition. It says any same-sex marriage, civil union, or substantially similar legal relationship entered into another jurisdiction shall be recognized in Illinois as a civil union, which means there are a lot of couples here that had either moved here from somewhere else or had a Vermont civil union, a California domestic partnership, or a Massachusetts or a Canadian marriage, or went there and have long since broken up and have been living apart but just haven't been able to get divorced. And as of June 1st, I filed several on June 1st of couples that it was all by agreement because they've been separated for some time. But there have been quite a number of them, of people who have now been able to get the one thing they're entitled to, which is a judgment of dissolution that's fully recognized under full faith and credit in every state. They can get rid of I don't mean to demean it, but they can actually now get a judgment of dissolution that they couldn't get before. That's been the wave of them.
So to stay true kind of to what we do, Richard and Rochelle here, is really try to help children and help them work through divorce. And we know they're not resilient and parental alienation comes into play. It's a horrible thing for a child to grow up with self-esteem and trust issues and inability to have relationships. And 48% of them don't want to get married. So when you add to that a gay or lesbian couple that has children, how are those children affected when there's a divorce?
Richard?
I'd like to hear from both of you.
Yeah, Rochelle, because Rochelle and I have been doing this for quite some time, and I'm sure we're both on the same page with it, but since I blabbed for the last 5 minutes, I thought...
That's all right. Jump in any time. It's my experience, I think Richard will probably agree, that the issues that confront heterosexual couples vis-a-vis children or dissolution are not that different in same-sex couples. And unfortunately, when I started thinking about this, I thought, oh, yeah, but there's not as much parental alienation in same-sex couples, but there really is. And if you look at the – it's my opinion, and I've also talked to some professionals because I wanted to make sure that I was being, neutral. The issues that confront heterosexual couples in regard to children is, in my opinion, the same. It has to do with power and the way that it's used and affected. Go ahead, Richard.
I agree completely. I think fundamentally and in practice there's absolutely no difference based on the gender of the relationship. I think the change or the difference that I see, and Rochelle will probably echo this, is that same-sex couples or same-sex parties, and whether it's a dissolution generally or a dissolution that involves children specifically, for so long have been marginalized in the legal system, and they tend to, therefore, be less inclined to believe they have any enforceable rights or interests or an ability to get that resolved, or they feel marginalized or afraid of the system. And what tends to happen, certainly not in all cases, but we've seen this, is that there, and you read about it in the paper, it's the horrible stories, is that people tend to use the other's disabilities as swords against them. whether they are trying to enforce that one parent isn't a legal parent and therefore has no standing, or any number of things where they try to then take advantage of the other's legal disabilities because they can. And that's, I think, the only difference. I think that that happens in traditional relationships where those where one party may have a legal leg up on the other on a particular issue and may try and take advantage of that. I think we see more of that in relationships where there is actually a legal problem of recognition or of enforcement or whatever.
So, Richard, are you alluding to the fact that it might be a biological child for that person as opposed to an adopted child for the both of them?
That's one issue. I mean, that happens. But, I mean, I think that happens actually less than people realize. There are, in my practice, I've traditionally, I don't know why, I think it just happens. If there is a biological parent and there's a non-biological parent, I tend to have a non-biological parent as a client, and I tend to find that we're just as successful obtaining agreements that validate each party's rights and interests. They're equal under the law, and I always try to work toward, because I fundamentally don't believe in taking advantage of the other party's disabilities or infirmities at law. So we tend to work towards some sort of a resolution, always with the best interest of the child. And because a biological parent doesn't have a superior legal right, if they're both legal parents, it doesn't matter who's biological and who's not.
Well, on that particular note, is there first? This is going to be a two-part question. I just ask you both of you the first part first. Is there an advantage to working with the biological parent, or is there something unique that the biological parent would? A unique kind of anger or more sense of entitlement. How does that play out?
Okay. I don't know that there's more of a sense of entitlement. It's been my experience that the actual biological parent in same-sex couples where there's co-adoptions thinks that they have an advantage because they gave birth. And the non-biological parent, of course, doesn't agree. And so often, it's interesting, it's not always the case, but the biological parent in same-sex relationships or co-adoptions are also the ones who tend to be the stay-at-home parent, whereas the other one is going out and making a living. It's not that different. The one who is out making a living is made to feel, this is where the parental alienation issue comes in too, is made to feel by the biological parent sometimes as though they were not the primary caregiver because the one was home and the one gave birth. The parent who is out making a living, and it's not that different, feels as though without what she or he have done, there would be no family, and she's done just as much for the child. So to me, that's where the power play kind of begins, and I do think that certainly women use the biological parent as their power, because otherwise they feel somehow disenfranchised because they're not often making money, not always, but often.
So what do the courts think? Are the courts favoring the biological?
I think they don't. I think it's a matter of education. I think in my experience, courts have not understood that. For example, under Section 601 of the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, you can bring a custody action of unmarried partners in the divorce division, and it's without regard to their relationship to each other if they're each legal parents. And so a lot of it over the years, and I'm sure Rochelle sees the same thing, has been just educating judges because they don't know. They think this is something that belongs in parentage court, for example.
So what Richard is saying, Michelle, is this is your next topic.
and part of it, I had it today in another unrelated case, which I won't go into, in another complete division of the court system, complete and utter shock, and shock simply based on ignorance. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean simply in the true sense of the word, ignorance by a judge that two women could adopt a child. And they were fighting over money, and the judge was completely unaware that they could go through a process of co-parent adoption, and I had to explain that that's permitted under First District Court decision, and that in many instances when there is a biological parent and there is a co-parent adoption, that the biological parent will terminate her rights or his rights immediately prior to a joint or co-parent adoption by both parties. And this, of course, it scares a lot of people because it sounds, you know, so a lot of it's just education. I mean, it's about creating families and creating legal rights. And like we all know, and I'm sure Judge Lawrence will echo this, that the best results are those that are invested by agreements of the parties. And when they're both invested and they're both keeping true to their commitment, irrespective of what happened in their relationship, but to be able to get them to a point where they're honoring their commitment to create a family, that they can somehow come to an agreement where both of their rights are validated and so on and so forth, it generally works for the best, and courts are much happier with finding those agreements to be in the child's best interest than having protracted disputes based on who's on the birth certificate, who has biology and who has not.
Well, I jokingly said a moment ago that this would be Michelle's next topic, but when I think about trying to do this kind of thing downstate or in any county that is, a farm community, very Christian-based, I think it would be extremely difficult to educate that judge who has been on the bench for years and years and years about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about that? Are you finding any kind of prejudicial, any kind of bias, anything showing up for either of you?
Much less in Cook County. Really, honestly, here in Chicago, I would say it's less very uncommon, what Richard described, which was in a different division. It has been my experience that the family law judges very quickly cleaved to this concept of civil union. And, you know, let's face it, I mean, you know, in the first day, second day, the act actually was enacted or signed into law on June, became effective June 1st of 2011. And by June 2nd, people were in there. I was in court by June 5th on a dissolution. And the judge I had, and I won't say anything surprised me, was extremely comfortable with the whole concept and went along with it. And you know that it was his first one or hers.
Right. And on top of it, it's great for us because they understand the process anyway. They understand the process of dissolution and the process of children in custody and how to proceed and how to do that the right way. I found that in the CLEs we do for the State Bar, for the ISBA, and also for ICCL, that a lot of downstate judges tend to come to these things because they've heard or they want to know more. They're tuned in. I think they're tuned in. I mean, it's anecdotal, but there has been, in what I've seen, a fair number of because we've tried to do for the ISBA, for example, different sort of a roadshow in different downstate communities on the new law and on the changes in the law.
What is involved in that roadshow? Is
basically
there any music?
Yeah. Animals and
we do a little bit of
clowns.
I mean, we do a little stand up.
I'm so sure you do, but that's one thing that I don't think people actually realize is that the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, which is our divorce law in the state, is, am I correct, completely applicable, and all of those rights and responsibilities are the same.
Right. Right.
Well,
the only
I want to ask you, answer that. Then I have a couple of questions that people actually wrote into me today that are joined civilly in Illinois. So answer that question, and then I want to ask you these two questions.
Well, to the extent that they have a civil union or that they have a recognized relationship, then it incorporates the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act. If they don't have a recognized relationship that is recognizable through the Civil Union Act, then they don't have anything.
But, however, also, it's interesting, the Act, and we have to remember the Act has yet to be interpreted, so, you know, it's time.
Meaning
but,
appealed.
Yeah, exactly. And the Act, Richard's right, I agree with him, but it's interesting because it specifically incorporates certain provisions, but it doesn't specifically incorporate, in other words, in the Act itself, it says sections 301 to 317 are specifically, incorporated or adopted, but it doesn't specifically incorporate, for example, provisions pertaining to custody, property support, and fees. It uses it, and it's applicable, but it doesn't specifically. And the same thing with sections pertaining to visitation. So it is applicable, but it's a question of I'm waiting to see how someone appeals.
Yeah, there's been talk about that provision, but my position has been both publicly and the way this has been played out. There's some lawyers who think this means something, that it did, that the act isn't functioning properly. But what Rochelle was referring to, there's a section of the act that says dissolution, and it basically says, how do you dissolve a civil union? Well, if it's by declaration of invalidity, it's 301 through 306, which
right,
is what
exactly.
Rochelle referred to. If it's divorce, it's 401 through 413. My answer to that is the IMDMA, the Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, also doesn't expressly incorporate 500s, the 600s, the 700s, the 800s. It says in 401 the court cannot grant a judgment of dissolution unless and until it's provided for the rest of the issues, the custody of the children, support of the spouse, support of the children, division of the property. So it all incorporates it under 401. It just doesn't. I think that section of the Civil Union Act is just
right.
Directing.
If it's
an annulment, it's in the 300s. If it's a divorce, it's in the 400s, and the rest follows through.
So to get into a little juicier question than the numbers of the Act, what do you? And I'd like you both to weigh in on this. What differences do you see between handling a case with two women versus two men?
Oh.
Gender differences. And you can't
there are
say none. That will be an unacceptable answer.
Do we have to?
You get right answer.
I have to confess, Judge, I got my BA in sociology, and my minor concentration was gender studies. So there's a lot of difference, but it has to do with how women are and how men are, to the extent that they're different. I think men approach things differently and women approach things differently, and I think Rochelle will probably agree that cases with two women are different from cases with a man and a woman, and cases with two men are different from cases with a man and a woman and than two women. How's that for an evasive answer?
It's not going to work
here
because
Richard, why? because of the gender and the personality of a woman as opposed to a man, or why? Why?
Yeah, I think socialization. Simply that I think men tend to be, and this is an extraordinary generalization. I think men also in divorces, in traditional divorces, I think men tend to not notice problems or not acknowledge them to the same extent that women do, and they minimize them, and they. As a rule, I mean, and they tend to sort of live with the structural problems that are going on, or whatever you want to call it. And I think women tend to be much more about process and making it work or fixing it or whatever. And I think that women try harder in that regard. And at some point, I think this is why still to this day more divorces are filed by women than by men. I think at some point women. Tend to cross the line and make a move, and that triggers, I think, an awakening among men. And again, I'm really generalizing, but I think that's sort of.
No, I think there's something a lot to what you're saying.
There is, and I think also in terms of, and I see this with women judges, I think women tend to, I can say this, I mean, I think they approach a problem completely differently than men do. And don't ask me how.
You know
well,
how.
Okay.
I'll let Rochelle answer that. How's that?
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to take a little bit, especially since, you're agreeing. I feel a little bit differently about this. I mean, part of me agrees with you, except that it really depends on the individuals involved.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think
because
it's
the personality,
a general rule that's applicable.
Yeah, I agree with you that women, I think you said women are better than men or something like that, but...
Oh.
Oh, you didn't say that. But women think differently. They do. But the roles in couples, any couples, heterosexual couples, same-sex couples, the roles play a part in what role each person takes. And I don't even mean necessarily gender roles. I mean who's the one who handles the finances, who's the one who handles the house responsibilities, who's the one with the money, who makes has the power. It's not, it's really not that different than roles in heterosexual couples, except that they're more clearly defined. That's all.
Right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Because I also find that's one thing that's different, that I find different in a same-sex relationship, the ability to fall into traditional expectations based on gender that you see time and again in opposite-sex relationships, not all, but certainly in a lot, isn't there. And so same-sex relationships don't have this sort of fallback where, you know, one's a woman and one's a man, and you have certain ideas of how you're supposed to behave or how you think you've been trained to behave or who knows what. But that's sort of liberating, and it also makes it more difficult. As Rochelle says, it becomes much more about, you know, who's earning the living if only one of them is, and who's doing this and who's doing that. But the stereotypical gender-assigned roles that still plague us are not as present or prevalent in,
that's right,
in same-sex relationships simply because there's no opposite.
That's right.
And you remember the last time that the three of us were together in court, I had said to you that over the years, in the order of protection call, you know, prior to civil union, when same-sex couples would come in for alleged violence or conflict or whatever it is, I said, and it's was my observation, that the emotions are really inflamed at first, but there is a greater ability to want to get to the other side and communicate deeper. So where the cases start off awful sometimes, sometimes you can end up working with the couples at a much better level that they want to come to some understanding once they release some of the emotional charge.
And the hurt and the anger, I agree with you. The one thing an observation that I've made, it's not exactly on point, it's not exactly on what we're talking about, is one of the distinctions that I have found in representing same-sex couples versus representing heterosexual couples is not any of the things that you would imagine. It's not necessarily that, you know, they each have certain roles or there are two men, and you know they just, you know, the stereotypes that all they want to do is decorate, and the two women that they want to play baseball. It's A, not true, but here's what the thing that has distinguished it in the past, especially before the Civil Union Act. There was no law there. There really wasn't law to support the relationship in same-sex couples, and that had a really amazing effect, is my observations. It's like couples who were able to co-adopt children, but as Richard said earlier, where their case went or did they have standing, if it was very muddied. And in not that long ago, what would happen is, and still happens if they did not have a civil union, if the same-sex couples bought a house together, owned it together, and co-adapted children, they had to have two cases going at the same time. We still have that, one in Chancery and one not. And those aspects, that aspect, I think, has a lot to do with the hostility and animosity that's created between the couples and trying to amicably dissolve their relationship. It becomes really too much anger there. They don't have any guidance or direction.
Or sense that they have, I often say that they have a forum where they'll be treated like equals.
Exactly.
And and that they'll be treated with appropriate respect. And Judge, I think it's a great point you made, because it falls back to that. I had a case that wound up in front of you several years ago, a same-sex custody case that had been roiling around for 3 years. It was on calendar D, and by the time it was settled and we had a joint custody agreement, and it was all, you know, all wonderful and all well, but it had started with a horrible order protection issue between my client and the other party. And I remember we were assigned to you randomly to do the prove up, and you did the prove up, and you then took a moment when you were done, and you it was priceless because both parties started to cry.
No.
Not because they started to cry made it priceless, but what I mean was you went off the record and you said, you know, I look at this and I see where you came from and how this case started out and all the difficulty and everything, and now you're standing here telling me you're going to jointly parent this child. I mean, and then you went to the next step where you asked them to just tell you how, you know, how they got there or what it was about the other party or whatever. I mean, it was priceless because I think for both of them, and I think Rochelle has seen this was the first time any person of authority had sort of addressed them like they assume married couples are addressed or people in these types of situations.
Yeah.
And it was astoundingly transformative for each of them. I mean, I really felt that this was going to bode well for their agreement because they realize that the court is recognizing them, treating them as equals, and affirming their sameness with everybody else with respect to these kinds of issues. I thought it was great. I mean, it just.
Oh, thank you.
And I think that's why Michelle is so incredibly, you know, just important and revolutionary in what she's doing in her courtroom. But I have to tell you, as I listen to this, I mean, we have an audience of alienated parents and parents who are divorcing who are not yet alienated, who go to court every day expecting to receive the common sense and justice and equality that they deserve under the Illinois divorce law or any state for anyone that's listening. And they walk out thinking, oh, my God, what happened here? And as someone who went through it, you know, there is nothing equal about anything that goes on in a family court unless you have a judge like Michelle in the state of Illinois.
Yeah.
I want to ask you to come. I would like to go back to unique problems for the children. Could you both tell us what are there unique problems for children? What are they? And how do they get worked through?
Well, again, I have to tell you this. I mean, I don't think the problems of children of same-sex couples here in Chicago or around are that much different. You would think they would be, but that they're that much different than of children of heterosexual couples. And the reason I say that is because things have changed dramatically in that regard, as far as I'm concerned. By the way, I have friends who would disagree, but when I first called and I was talking to Jill about this particular generation of young people and kids, for the most part, I find are much more embracing of different families. They're more used to it. It's on television. They see it every day than, for example, we were. And so I don't know that they necessarily encounter the kinds of issues that I would expect them to. I know that they do, but not overall. I have not yet encountered that with clients that I've represented. It's one of the first questions I ask. Do you have any problems? How is the families, the neighbors, the schools? And for the most part, the reaction or response I get is that's not a problem, the fact that they're gay.
Let's say they're downstate. I mean, let's
That's
say because
different.
We have people who listen to this are far more and wide, not even in Illinois, mm-hmm. or in smaller towns. So it's not strictly Cook County. So what kind of problems, if that wasn't the case, they weren't in a sophisticated urban environment?
Well, I think prejudice, fear, which mm-hmm. tends to fuel prejudice, fear of difference, fear of unknowns, is as common in sophisticated urban environments as it is in rural. It's just different, and I think that based on at least on what I've seen, I've had a number of cases over the years that involve people in different locations that I was surprised that the families and everybody knew or had embraced these couples or they raised their children or what, you know, everybody was doing. It's just the face to the outside world was put differently based upon the location or where they were living or how they were living. And I think those are the official religious explanations or political explanations were different. And I sort of think that's what it boils down to, the community and how the community deals with these kinds of things. But I think Rochelle is right. I mean, the generational shift has been profound, and I think partly it's because it's just not threatening anymore. It's just kids are not. I mean, there's plenty of evidence about, unfortunately, about gay suicides and bullying still going on in awful amounts. But by the same token, I think a lot of that's because people are talking about it more. It's been going on for a long time. It's just we haven't been talking about it. And I think if there's anybody's evidence of, Judge, maybe your initial part of your question, if you're familiar with Zach Walls, the 19-year-old that went before the Iowa legislature and gave that incredible speech, which is on YouTube and everybody should read. I mean, so eloquent, and having been raised by two women and basically defying the hate that was floating through the legislature on the marriage bill, or the attempt to undo the marriage decision. It's amazing because he's 19, he's not 12 or 11, and where you find, I think, kids are even more open and more in tune to not seeing this as problematic as it had been. I think it's just different, but I do think I don't mean to discount it. I think downstate or in more rural areas or areas that are not as urban and sophisticated, there is another layer of problem. I think people feel more exposed or vulnerable because it's smaller communities and everybody knows everybody. Maybe that mm-hmm. has,
and also
has,
yeah. and there is a lot in those communities and situations, a lot of bullying that goes on.
Well, there's still such a stigma attached in so many of the small communities in so many states, and not just in central Illinois, but all over. Do you think, and I want to talk about it both from an adoption standpoint and from a biological child standpoint, what would be the best recipe to establish if you're going to get a divorce, how, and you certainly don't go into it with that thought, but down the road, if you're getting a divorce, what would you tell parents who are adopting a child and then who have a child biologically to do legally to set up their guardianship or parentage before the event of divorce in order to kind of circumvent future strain of the relationship with your children?
Well, the ideal thing is to have a type of agreement, not unlike a prenuptial agreement, whether or not it would, withhold the scrutiny of attack, I don't know, but at least it would show the intent. And by that I mean, if people are, especially if same-sex couples are co-adopting, it would be great to have a co-adoption agreement which sets forth what their intent is. And still, though, it's very hard to do that because, you adopt infants, people are in love, the relationship is great, and 10 years later there's problems and things have changed. So it's still hard, but it would help to at least express what the parties intended originally.
It's hard because it's not enforceable.
Of course.
Or may not be. I mean, I agree. I think that the honoring of agreements is so critical. And if it's also the same problem, though, with prenuptial agreements. I mean, people in love, as Rochelle said, they're not in the mood to negotiate, or they're not in the mood to think about negotiating. It's harder for people to conceptualize or to do at that point or that stage in their relationship. But as far as parentage is concerned, at least in a place like Illinois and in a lot of jurisdictions, where we don't recognize intended parentage, de facto parentage, or other forms of equitable parentage that a lot of states recognize. Here, if you're legally a parent, you have everything, and if you're not, you have nothing. So you're treated worse than absent grandparents. And so I always urge people, no matter, especially where the relationship is questionable because it's civil unions versus this or that, or who knows if it's recognizable when you cross into Wisconsin or Indiana, who knows. But if you adopt your children, there's no question. It's full faith and credit. It's everywhere. And so even in same-sex marriages that are valid in one state but maybe not in another, I think the best advice to people is to adopt their children. It sounds weird. I mean, some people can't imagine
Doesn't
why they should have
weird.
To. But the relationship fails, and the legal relationship between the parties is different from the legal relationship between parent to child. And too many times I've seen a parent who's been, like Rochelle said, a primary caregiver of a child, but, and we have a horrible case out of the First District in Illinois who was a primary caregiver and never adopted or never established legal parentage and was completely shut out of this child's life, and that's still good law. So,
I'd like to, it would be helpful if, from your vantage point, if you could each weigh in as if you were giving advice to same-sex couple on parenting. I'd like to know what mistakes you think people make going through the divorce. And, you know, to answer that first, and then I'm going to ask you if.
Well, what do you mean, as people go through or proceed through a divorce, what mistakes they make in that process or before they ever get to that stage? Varies in each.
Well, let's start with the divorce process, what mistakes they make in terms of parenting, or because I certainly see it in heterosexual couples, like I could write a book.
Well, you have you not?
Yes. Didn't you?
Write another one.
Well, I thought maybe I'd let you do it.
I think that one of, again, you know, I would like to say it's very, very different than heterosexual couples, but there are some similarities. The way people act them out might be a little bit different, but it's out of the anger. It's the same thing as the parental alienation. They use the anger and they use the power that they have to really alienate the children. They don't necessarily always know they're doing that. In fact, most often they don't. But for example, I've observed this when it's two women and one is home with the children and the other one is out making money. The one home with the children and/or was the biological parent really uses that. And if I find this to be true, also in heterosexual couples, if the arrangement with the children strikes the moneyed parent or the parent with the money power as fair, that parent is pretty generous about the money and how to work it out and what to give. But if it's not, if they perceive that the arrangements with the children or the direction that it's going in is not fair, then or balanced, then what happens is they suddenly react to everything. They may have to pay child support, but when it comes to other things like extracurricular activities or things like that, they're much less inclined. So the first, for me, what I said earlier about if parents are co-adopting or for heterosexual couples who are having children, I do not think it's a bad idea. It doesn't have to be a formal agreement, but for them to sit down and work out some sort of a plan of intent. I'll tell you why. It doesn't have to be upheld because 10 years later, and I see this all the time, one parent will say to the other, you promised me if this, this, and this, this would happen. You told me. And the other person says, no, I didn't. And, of course, if they have some sort of plan of how they're going to parent the children, it's really helpful. And then when if their marriage dissolves or if their relationship dissolves or if their civil union dissolves, at least they have that as a guide. The other thing is parents don't do it, though, until they're in trouble. I think it would be really helpful for both parents, whatever.
Sort of like a post, not a prenuptial exactly, a pre-civil union, a post-civil union agreement after
the
children.
Well, they may not even have, right. They may not even have the union, but they've adopted the child. I think that the
parenting
law.
Parenting plan.
I'm sorry.
Sort of parenting plan.
Yeah, I think that the law should change and evolve to focus first on the child and the relationship of the child to the parties, and dispense with or get rid of this formal requirement that they have legal parentage, because plenty of states have long since moved in the direction of recognizing intended parentage, and that parties have set up households and just not formally adopted, but there's the doctrine of de facto parentage and psychological parentage, and these children bond with both parties. And then you have, because you, there's no other way to, part of it, judges, is holding the parties responsible for their agreements and for their acts. I have another one where I saw recently that they split up and they were angry enough at each other, and each had given birth to one of the two children, and one just took her child and left. And left the other one, who was older, and moved 10 states away, and left the older child without her younger sibling and her other mother, and completely, completely screwed up. She's in counseling. It doesn't know, you know, what happened, what's wrong with her, whatever. And parents shouldn't be allowed to do this. They simply shouldn't be. They should be. The law should look at the child and the child's relationship to the parties, and whether, you know, there's a sufficient basis. There are plenty of tests states have adopted in terms of what constitutes sufficient intended parentage, and it should therefore keep the parties on the hook, because they're, as you know, they're whatever their discord is in terms of their relationship, that's going to take a while to get through anyway. A lot of this is just giving them the time to get through that, but what happens to the kid in the meantime? And I just think it's terrible that you know, we say, well, you're a legal parent and you're not, so we're not even going to listen to you. And meanwhile, the kid, the child, is completely confused, because those kind of distinctions are completely irrelevant or uninteresting, at least.
Bravo, Richard. It's so refreshing to hear this. I love it.
Well,
terrific.
It breaks my heart when I see these parties, not to mention the kids, getting screwed like this because of the legal distinctions.
I wish we would have had you. I serve on the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, and we rewrote the IMDMA that is going to be introduced in front of the state legislature this spring.
Right.
And, boy, I wish you would have been there.
So to pull back focus for a minute, I'd like to just educate everybody about the implications of the Defense of Marriage Act, which is federal law, and how this applies to everything. Richard, I know you know a lot about that, and you write about it.
Simply put, it's just a federal law in its most rudimentary sense. It's a federal law that says for purposes of federal law, marriage only means a legal union between one man and one woman, and spouse only means a party to a legal marriage. And so all of federal law now depends upon these two definitions of marriage and spouse. So anything that a party in all of our day-to-day lives, based on our relationships, brushes with federal law, which is ironic simply because it's the state that allows you to marry and allows you to divorce, and federal determinations have traditionally deferred to the states. But anything from Social Security benefits, survivor benefits, pensions, health insurance, taxes, all anything that involves federal law, a non-traditional marriage is not recognized. And so your Illinois civil union that has gone so far to recognize and make equal parties to a civil union to parties to a marriage under Illinois law has lots of problems when it comes
with
DOMA.
Things that are federal rights.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All federal rights. Anytime that anything says spouse, and that would be any pension benefits, firemen, policemen, that's the way, anything that says that, and by the way, there are about 608 laws that would fall into that category.
But it's actually, it's over 1,300 now.
Now?
On the federal
really?
Level alone. Yeah.
Okay, well, we just have a few minutes left, and I want to ask both of you to respond to this question. If you live in a state that doesn't recognize gay union, or one that doesn't allow you to legally split, is getting married worth the risks and potential costs of not being able to divorce?
Go ahead, Rochelle.
It's all right.
One of our listeners' questions, so...
It depends on the parties and what they want to do.
Yeah.
But I've encouraged people in Illinois, even though it was illegal to leave the state and get a marriage somewhere that you couldn't get here, if they felt, because look, the law continues to change and these barriers continue to drop, and if people in a society that marriage matters over everything and everything else is nothing, when all the benefits are accorded based on marital status and nothing else, common law, nothing else is really recognized, cohabitation, all of that, if people want to get married, they should be able to, when the state puts so much emphasis on it, it should be available to everybody, and they if they can't get it here, they should go and get it where they can get it. They may end up living in a recognized state the next day, who knows, or the next year.
Well, I want to ask you to give your contact information, if you would be willing to do that, and then I'm going to ask you both individually, in closing, to talk about what still needs to happen. So, Rochelle Grimbaugh, would you be willing to give your contact information for people?
Sure.
Who would like to call you about some legal services,
sure,
whatever they need?
Sure. It's Rochelle Grimbaugh, and the phone number, Chicago, Illinois, 312-781-0193. And I don't have a website yet. It's in the works.
Okay. And Richard Wilson?
Sure. It's Richard Wilson. My firm name is Grund and Leavitt, L-E-A-V-I-T-T, and my there is a website, grundlaw.com, and the phone number is 312-640-0500.
So, Rochelle, what still needs to happen in Illinois?
Well, in Illinois, I think that we're on the right path, but I still think that it needs to be, marriage needs to be legalized in Illinois, and I think the Civil Union Act is very important. It's certainly an important stepping stone. But the truth is, what just happened in California, and I don't know if that will withstand, you know, other attacks, they need to legalize marriage. I mean, there was a time that long ago, I regret to say, where it was, and this goes back to 1967, the case of Loving versus Commonwealth in Virginia, where it was illegal for people to marry someone who was not of their race. There was a state ban on interracial marriage. And when we say that now, I have people say, well, that's totally different. It's not different. And at that time, the Supreme Court then found that it is persons to classify people on the basis of race is violates equal protection and due process, and is a freedom to marry or not marry persons of another race resides with the individual and should not be infringed upon by the state. Well, if that's true of people of different races, it should be true of people who are of the same sex. That would be my biggest issue.
Well said.
That's for sure. And we've looked at so many things that have changed, you know, the civil rights movement, the disability community has changed over the last 20 years, and we're seeing this sort of evolve into something different, and it's exciting, and we'll just watch to see how it progresses. This has been a terrific show for me, and I've learned so much from both of you, and Richard and Rochelle, thank you for giving us your time tonight.
Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate being on the show. It was really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. I always learn so much. Well, anytime you guys are in my courtroom, I'm the beneficiary.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Since we have 1 minute, what needs to happen still, Richard?
I agree with everything Rochelle said. I think the distinction marriage civil union is an artificial one, and we all ought to just accept it and move on. And I think if we don't, the generation behind us is quickly nipping at our ankles because they simply don't get it. They don't get it, and they haven't gotten it now for at least 10 years, and the change is becoming. I mean, we've had same-sex marriage throughout the world legal only in 10 years, and now it's in 20 countries, and it's all over the place. It's just the change has just been, and Washington State this afternoon has now finally passed the bill, and the governor's going to sign it, and California yesterday. I mean, it's an artificial distinction, and on top of it, as I said before, I think we need to get over this artificial formal distinction about what a parent is and focus on what the child is and what the relationship of the child is to each of the parties and work it backward from there like so many states are doing, because it really protects children in a much better way and I think binds the parents the way they probably want to be bound but can't see because they're in so much discord with the other party while the child needs protection, and children's lives are not that long by the time they reach adolescence, so it's critical, and I think we just need to get there by some other means than the way we're doing it now.
Well said, well said, and change is coming, and we'll all be there. Well, hopefully, we'll all be there for it.
Just one last thing. I just have to say this. I have to say it. Judge Lawrence, I think you know how much we appreciate what you do in the courtroom, but just in case you don't, we really do.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you.
I agree.
That means a lot. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
thank you
for your time and your brilliance and wisdom, and we look forward to more.
Thank you.
And on February 22nd, everybody tune in. We have Dr. Rebecca Bailey from California, J.C. Dugard's mental health professional. She is an exciting psychotherapist working with horses and cooking to help people work through divorce, parental alienation. And in J.C.'s case, of course, everyone knows that international story about her being kept in a backyard for her entire life by a man in California. So it'll be an exciting show.
Yeah.
And we hope that you all tune in. Thank you so much for being here tonight and listening in to this conversation with Richard and Rochelle. And everybody have a great night and a great weekend. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Bye, Jill. See you later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.